What would save the world?
Veganism.
Gun control.
Ending capitalism.
Consensus.
More guns.
Nonviolent communication.
Energy.
Green energy.
Spirituality.
More regulation.
Emotional education.
End the war
libertarianism.
On drugs.
Socialism.
I'm Tuke Edelo, and this is
What Would Save the World on Radio Free Brooklyn every Wednesday from 3 to 4 p.m.
That awesome music you heard on the intro is by William Mulsom. You can check him out on soundcloud.com/William Mulsom. Mulsom spelled M-A-L-S-A-M. Also check it out on facebook.com/What Would Save the World.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, non-binaries, creatures, and reptilians, I would like to introduce a new segment of What Would Save the World. It is a radio play based on a true story, a nomadic story, an Occupy story, a story of dreams, failures, and mediocrity, entitled Don't Need No Golden Ticket, written by Tuke Edelo. Each week, we will share a short new episode on What Would Save the World. It is a story very close to my heart. Magic is real. It is, that I can assure you. Happy travels. And off we go.
It's a slightly windy but warm southern November day in the historical town of San Antonio, Texas. Lonesome shadows hover around the abandoned houses that reside in the park of an earlier time, of a time of great excitement and settlement. The modern times, the new age, the time of internet protest. Occupy Wall Street had started from the modern streets of the financial district, where reptilian shapeshifters were rumored to hold residence in the basements of the office buildings. The protest spread to the every corner of the country and beyond, mostly inspired through social media. These abandoned houses of San Antonio were no longer settled, but the porches were occupied by the Muppet Punk Children and the Neverlandian backpackers in search for the answers to questions they could not quite articulate. LSD-enhanced visuals of the mind's eye, blotter-tabbed words and gut feelings guided the steps of Lizzie, a member of the New York occupation. She had charmed her way down the coast. A notebook in hand, she found her way to San Antonio. Temporary tribes formed at these occupations. For Lizzie, Family Occupy San Antonio edition consisted of Terrence, a young model, Gonzo, a guy with turquoise and pink hair, Sarah, a waitress with something to say, and Coffee, the kind of guy who likes to say meow a lot. Lizzie wanders back over to the porch on this fall day. Terrence has a pair of Doc Martens next to him. Lizzie walks up wearing jeans covered in paint and a sweater. She is wearing boots that are somewhat too large for her. Lizzie comes over humming Pure Imagination from Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
That lady was full of shit. That guy didn't look like Gene Wilder at all. He was just playing a computer game. He looked a bit like Gene Wilder. Not much, though. He didn't even have a twinkle in his eyes.
Coffee runs up to her, nuzzles her.
Meow, meow, meow.
Meow, meow, meow.
Did you at least get to interview him? You were in a real hurry to make sure you got to talk to him before he left.
Lizzie, Gonzo was gonna wear these docks, but they were too small. I thought it might fit his style. No.
Coffee! This is what I was talking about!
Meow?
Remember how I was explaining manifestation before?
Meow.
You know, it's like, when you visualize something long enough, it will come. If you ask the universe, you shall receive. But you have to really believe. But you also need to be okay with things if they don't work out for whatever reason. Like, maybe I will never meet a man who looks like Gene Wilder, and that's okay, I guess.
So, do you want the shoes?
Abso-fucking-lutely! Thanks, man! But you wouldn't believe it. See these boots? These are too damn big. I'm still grateful to have had them. Do you want them? Let's trade. When I was in Florida, I must have talked for a week about how I could not leave Florida until I had boots. So finally, this one dude said he knew this girl with boots, that she didn't like how she felt. He eventually convinced her to give them to me. I knew I had to keep them. Otherwise, I'd probably still be in Florida, or I'd only have these water shoes I had. So I got a pair of boots. And now, another has come my way. I believed hard enough.
I guess I can see what you're saying.
You're always on about some fairy tale hocus-pocus shit.
Oh, shush, Shara. You're the one who thinks she's a succubus or whatever.
Look, man, girl gets what she wants. I have to work for it.
Don't work for it. It's poor people who make it all hard. Try to make them take it from us.
Fuck, Terrence. Sometimes you're nice, but why are you even here?
Well, let's kill all people in third world countries. We'll be fine.
What's wrong with you? Why are you at Occupy?
Meow.
The only reason people are poor is because they don't care enough about each other. It is not that hard to share. You're sharing with me right now, giving me these shoes.
You should try modeling. You could totally be a model.
I'm not trying to help with mainstream advertisements.
Whatever.
But also, Sarah, I can recognize in the past that I've used sexuality responsibly, but I can definitely get my needs met without fucking whoever. I'm celibate right now, actually.
I'm just saying you've got some dark powers to be able to make people like Terrence give you stuff.
It's not magic. It's the way the universe is right now. Our consciousness is changing as a species. We are not finished evolving. I believe deep down he wants to be good.
I am good. I'm great. So be attractive.
Your ideas are a little twisted, not going to lie, but I see you on the wavelength. Somewhere, I guess that's probably why you're here.
I'm confused. What does this have to do with Doc Martens, meow?
So, do you want him?
Oh yeah, thanks, definitely. I was just writing about all the magic it... Thanks again, guys. I gotta take this. Hey, Gigi. Oh my god, it's so nice to hear your voice. Yeah, I'm still traveling. I'm on the road. I'm in San Antonio! Texas! At the occupation! It's fucking ridiculous! We aren't even allowed to march here. I know. It's the revolution. Something crazy is happening here, even if we can't march. I think I'm headed to Tucson next. I'm gonna meet up with Milo. No, Dom and him left me in Florida. I told them to. It's way too hard to be around Dom. It's because I still love him. I miss him. I know it wasn't really working, but I can't help that I still love him. I need to stop thinking about it. Their journey is about all humans and life coming together and realizing we are one. No more violence, no more hatred, love for everyone, universal love. I believe that deep down he loves me. Everything is connected and he knows it especially. He was always on and on about how we're all one. I feel like something's coming. Something incredible. I feel like it's going to be for everyone. Things are going to change. This revolution is not just political. We're all becoming more conscious, realizing the connection. Yeah, you're right. That's all that matters, that I remember to just be compassionate. Doesn't stop me from being sad. I have to go. Excuse me, sir. Do you hop trains? You look just like Gene Wilder.
Thank you so much for listening to Don't Need No Golden Ticket on What Would Save the World on Radio Free Brooklyn. You can catch me here every Wednesday from 3 to 4 p.m. and you can hear the next episode of this episodic radio play that I've written on November 30th. That's in 2 weeks. And I want to thank the voice actors. I want to thank Michaela Duran-Krellen for playing Lizzie, for doing the narration. I want to thank Freeze Frame. I want to thank Lee Salas for playing multiple characters and for playing one of the major characters coming up on November 30th. You should really check that out. And I filled in on a couple voices there. And I want to say that that is based on a true story. It's based on something I experienced in my life at a time where I feel like I was just searching for magic. Like, I just understood how beautiful life really is. And I think I still do, but I was so full of wonderment. Maybe I'm romanticizing the vibe I was on, but at the same time, I feel like I was a hypocrite, so I have to examine that. And that's what I'm doing in this play, but I want to talk about magic and how I think that magic is science. And I think that science and magic are both about patterns and synchronicity and how fucking incredible that all is. Like, just the fact that we happen to be on this planet, that we happen to be alive and have made it this far through evolution. Like, those are just a series of patterns that are, it's miraculous that they came together that way. And I think I forget how vast it is, and I don't like how jaded I've become, and I don't like how jaded a lot of people are. And I think that if we believed in magic just a little bit more, we could save the world. That sounds really cheesy, but I believe it. And whenever people call me a child or tell me I'm being like a little girl when I talk about my ideals and my beliefs in magic, I'm not ashamed of being called a child. I think that if the world were run by some of the children I know, the world would be a much better place. Thank you for listening to Don't Need No Golden Ticket. Tune in November 30th to check out the next episode, 3 to 4 p.m. on What Would Save the World on Radio Free Brooklyn.
All right, so I hired this guy. His name is John Hannison. He's going to be investigating some cult activity. I don't know. It's like this strange place. It's like a church that's supposed to be feminist or a cult. We're not really sure. So he's investigating it for me. And here is the first report.
A question asked by egomaniacs and egomaniacs alone. The truly insane, though, would think they have the answer. At least that is what I thought. A mere 5 days ago when I first began my report on the Church of Thrall, an organization originating from the small town of Thrall, Texas, that has recently been in the Voice Village for its statements regarding the immorality of women in the military. This is John Hannison, reporting for Tuke Edelow and Radio Free Brooklyn on the difference between a cult and a sanctuary in another installment of The Heartbeat Underground. The title of this journal, turned story, turned obsession. My mirror is the mirror of light. My mirror is in the hallway. Of course, any report on the Church of Thrall must begin with an examination of its founder and leader, Yahwasius Thunderblood, a powerful man in stature alone, standing at 6'3" with a wide yet wire-like gait. He has slicked hair, streaking in geometrically perfect lines of black and silver toward the base of his neck. A long, trimmed beard rides his jawline, embellishing his cigar-stained laughs. Most strikingly, his hands are always shaking. Here is a snippet of our first interview. His voice was altered per his request. Please note that the background noise is a thunderstorm that happened on the day of our meeting.
Many people have commented on my hands over the years.
Why? Why do they shake so constantly?
Do they?
To my eyes, yes. Clearly.
Well, I think only a madman's hands wouldn't shake after writing the word direct from the mouth of God for over 20 years.
Do you know how crazy that makes you sound?
I never agreed my hands were shaking, John.
Yahwasius Thunderblood looks like cemetery grounds, full of past lives and arcane knowledge. Understanding him will be essential to understanding the mirror. I arrived in Thrall, Texas on November 10th on rented wheels, tight luggage, and little sleep. My first stop was on the local motel on Howard Road and Phillips Drive. Every street in the entire town is a colloquial boy's name, like Bob or Joe. There is even a lane towards the northern limits. I have yet to visit the landmark. The lone motel in Thrall is a dingy stay. My room has grayish-green carpet with a few brown patches, roach powder and clumps on the windows and sodded under the doors. Crucifixes hang on each of the four walls. Every inch of glass is rubbed with congealed dust. The buzz of the overhead fan waddles down on the mattress as I sleep, like a breathing of a hulking, freakish mosquito. My reports, except where noted, will come from top this bed. I apologize for any disturbance in the audio quality. My request to change rooms has been ignored due to the staff's general, likely genial, apathy. I am currently the only occupant. The next installment will be my account of meeting the congregation of the Church of Thrall and their leader at a local bazaar and fair. The experience, and those that quickly followed, may account for the odd, subdued mood the listener currently finds me in. Tune in next week to the heartbeat underground. But what does it mean? My mirror is the mirror of light. My mirror is in the hallway.
Hello and welcome to What Would Save the World, Caitlin Bailey. And I know Caitlin Bailey through Comedy World and stuff, but she recently just did a show called Contagious. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, Contagious. It's my one-woman show about being a prostitute in high school for no good reason. So, you know, it's an hour of that.
So I wanted to know, like, so what? Why did you decide to do that show specifically?
Well, the show sort of happened. I was in an abusive relationship with a dude who told me that, like, no one could ever love me because I once had sex for money. With this, like, once a whore, always a whore sort of thesis that exists in the world. So I mulled on that for, like, 2 years. And then I got into a knockdown, drag-out fight with my mother about, like, a futon that neither of us owned. And we ended up not speaking for 7 months, which gave me the space to write a piece, like, imagining that I existed in a vacuum and that it wouldn't impact my family, which I think is how a lot of those pieces have to get written. And then I produced it, and then it kept going. So now my family and I are talking again, but the show exists already.
Do you think you're going to do it again?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm going to try to put together a national tour.
Great.
I'm working on that. That'll happen in 2017. I'm trying to get the logistics set up for the rest of the year.
And people can find out more information about
this. Contagiouslaughter.com, and it is CUNTAGIOUS, laughter. You know how to spell laughter.
Yeah. Hopefully.
Yeah, or, you know, just try it out.
Ask somebody.
Sound it out.
So specifically, I want to know, why do you think the general public has such a negative perspective towards sex work of all kinds? Like, why is that a thing that you should be scared to tell your family about?
Sure. Well, I mean, the way that we think about sex work has changed and morphed over, you know, human history. Like, you look at ancient Greece, you look at ancient Rome, you look at ancient India, you look at, you know, Aztec, you look at the British Empire, French, like people have thought of different kinds of sex workers existing in different social spaces differently all the time. And I would say that, like, as a culture, we've been playing whack-a-mole with different oppressed groups for a long time. So I believe that, like sex workers became criminalized in the United States between, like, 1870 and 1900. I think Connecticut was the first state. This is during a time period in the United States where we're dealing with the fallout of the Civil War. We're dealing with the ramp up to women's suffrage. There's a lot of different kinds of social movements, and we have a little bit of a, like, national religious revival that happens, which is how the temperance movement starts. So it's this religious revival comes with, like, let's outlaw alcohol and prostitution and abortion and socializing with black people. So it's like this whole thing that happens during this time. So that's when it happened here. Before that, prostitutes were still socially marginalized, but they weren't being arrested at the same rate and in the same way. They were being arrested for things like loitering or public drunkenness or, mm-hmm. you know, insert city ordinance here, but they weren't being gone after as prostitutes. Mm-hmm.
So it was like profiling, prostitute profiling.
I mean, for 5,000 years, we've been waging a war on the dangers of feminine sexuality. You know, we wrote Mary Magdalene out of the fucking Bible.
Lilith.
I mean, like, we used to be human beings have been worshiping at the altar of the female vagina for most of human history. I mean, think about it. Like, you look around for a god. Do you pick a dude who can beat you in an arm wrestling contest or somebody that can make a person with their body that has a whole system in their body that talks to the fucking moon? Like, it's just, there's nothing not magic about that. So I think that is very threatening. And our overreaction to that has been to try to stigmatize female sexuality, and whores are it's a byproduct of that.
Do you think like a lot of that has come from religion? Like you said, like that it was like the revival of religion, but do you think some of like the demonization of genitals comes from religion?
Maybe. I think the religion is a tool to achieve that end. I don't think that that's like the primary function of religion. I don't think that's it's inevitable with all religions. I don't think that all religions have to like demonize.
I mean, I just think like the Christian Judeo religions have a tendency to demonize sexuality overall.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think that that's a product of the time and place that they're a part of. I think that they were doing a very similar thing with the Judeo-Christian religion that was happening under the Roman Empire, which is like the elevation of masculine values and the degradation of feminine values.
Mm-hmm. I mean, do you think some of the historical demonization of sex work also comes from like having a higher risk of diseases than we have now, because now we have condoms and stuff?
I don't know that any of those fears have been rational. So like you talk about a pre-AIDS world where you talk about like... you know, you're talking about syphilis, you're talking about gonorrhea, and you're talking about a time before germ theory, before antibiotics, all of that jazz. But the truth of the matter is that your average chambermaid, who is probably getting some, whether it's consensual or not, because of her social status and isolation, is going to know less about STDs, mm-hmm. how to prevent unwanted pregnancy, and how to take care of her nether regions than somebody who is a sex worker and socializing with other sex workers, where they're able to pool and share knowledge with each other.
That makes sense.
So I would say that like slutty bitches have always been more of a threat from like a health perspective than whores.
Yeah, I hear that actually. Because I was thinking about like how maybe some of the demonization of like, not the demonization, like the negative view towards like herpes, which isn't even really that big of a problem.
It's like having contagious acne.
Yeah, pretty much. And then I guess people who would have sex more would more likely to have it, but then it's not even that big of a deal.
Right. So I mean, I don't think that it's rational.
You don't think it's rational?
I don't think it's rational. I don't know that it's ever been rational.
Especially because we have more diseases now that you can get.
Right.
And yeah, and we're more well read.
You can get Zika through a dick. Did you know that?
That's no.
Crazy.
That's crazy.
Right? And then nuts?
That is.
Zika.
So I'm going to move on a little bit to something a little different. Do you think that sex is a need? Like, how do you view it as compared to food and water?
Yes.
Yes, that's it?
Yes.
Okay.
End of. No, I think that it's a primal force. We share that instinct and impulse with every other species. And I mean, you just can't. It's just a driving force. You know what I mean? And like I experience this with clients, and I feel like I see it in the world where, you know, you can really only deny, repress, transmute your sexual desires for so long before something really weird happens.
Yeah, whether it's sex or it just becomes like intense depression, which I would consider to be fatal. Mm-hmm. Or depression can be fatal.
Yeah, I mean, or it can manifest itself in other ways. You know, we've got a really long history, I would argue, of trying to redirect frustrated male sexual energy into like what makes a good soldier.
Mm-hmm.
So there might be like a shared social interest in keeping us all like just a little bit hungry for dick or whatever.
To make it that people will be more willing to go to war. See, now I would argue that I would prefer that to not be the case. Like maybe if people had more sex, there'd be less violence.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you might prefer that, but historically speaking,
oh, yeah.
You know, we're the hegemon, so it's important for us to have a, you know, ready to go army.
Unfortunately,
if we were all just like happy and pancakes and making everyone come, then you know we might get invaded by a more sexually repressed tribe.
We're all just trying to protect ourselves from sexual repression.
Yeah, we can't just give people syrup and weed and orgasms or we'll lose the next big war.
Because we'll not be able to fight the people who don't have orgasms.
Yeah.
All right, so because of that, I guess this answers the other question I had, which is, do you think sex is a necessary service? I think it is.
Yeah, I do
think, because capitalism is a service-based society.
Sure, we can talk about like how we, you know, monetize different elements of the service industry. I think that anyone who's worked in food and bev knows that like hospitality, which people used to think of being an uncommoditizable thing, is definitely commoditizable. I don't know. Is that the word, commoditizable? You can commoditize it. I'm pretty high.
Are you?
I mean, just a little bit. But so, I absolutely think it's a necessary service. And I think that one of the strongest pieces of evidence that I've ever seen for that is that it actually predates us as a species. We see evidence of exchanging sex for nesting material, food, and other like items of value in monkeys, apes, and even penguins. Like, wow. There are different kinds of species out there that have pair bonded, sort of like we do as a species, that then have extramarital sex for like nesting supplies or extra food or like other things that matter to animals.
See, that's fascinating to me, because right? That leads me to my later, like, what if we didn't have capitalism questions about this?
Sure, so we'd still have prostitution.
We'd still have prostitution. Yeah, so, I was going to actually ask you about...
I don't think that prostitution is a result or a symptom of capitalism, because it predates it.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense. So we were going to talk a little bit about how there's like a discussion right now between the decriminalization versus legalization of sex work. So I want to hear your opinions on that.
Well, we should probably tell your listeners what that is. Most people don't know what that is. Yeah. So decriminalization basically means that you take all of the anti-prostitution laws and they go away, and prostitutes have to operate as regular workers, but they don't have special laws that specifically apply to them. Sort of like how we don't have special laws that apply to graphic designers, whether you're working in a big firm or as a freelancer, you don't have this, you have to be a worker. Like, the contracts matter, and you know, you can't shoot people or give them diseases. You have to operate within society. Legalization means that a special set of laws specifically targeting sex workers is created. The only example that we have of that here in the U.S. are the legal brothels that operate in some counties in Nevada. We've seen decriminalization in this country, kind of. We saw it before 1900. We also saw Rhode Island accidentally decriminalized indoor prostitution between 1980 and 2009, which was pretty cool.
How did they catch that? How did that accidentally happen?
Here's what happened. So Coyote, which is a sex worker rights advocacy group, sued Rhode Island because of sex discrimination in the way that they were applying their anti-prostitution laws. They were arresting way more women than they were men, even though the buying and also the selling of sex was the same level of illegal. So they successfully sued Rhode Island, and the Rhode Island Congress was tasked with rewriting the law, and they just like didn't include indoor prostitution. So you still have streetwalkers who are being arrested. You still have like people who are being targeted, but massage parlors and independent escorts operating outside of their home pretty much just did that in Rhode Island for a while. In 2003, there was a massage parlor who was raided by the police, and they took them to court and said, "You can't arrest us. This isn't illegal." And then a judge was like, "Oh shit, what?" And so then there was like a state effort from 2003 until 2009. And it took them 6 years to recriminalize prostitution in Rhode Island.
Because that's a lot of time.
There was, well, you know, they had to argue about it, and there was fundraising. Everyone's fucking a whore.
So no, I mean, like, that's like a lot of time to be focused on that when we have so many other issues.
I mean, Rhode Island, in all fairness, is a really small state.
Yeah, I have a lot of time to talk about sex work, I guess.
Right, you know, they're still arguing about that one fence that everyone sees.
Okay, so let's continue that conversation on decriminalization versus legalization. Like, so now that we've explained that, what do you think? Like, what do you think it should be?
I think that decriminalization is the answer if one of your goals is to reduce human suffering. And one of the problems that I've seen with the like legalization model, like prostitution has been legal in some counties in Nevada since 1971. It also has the highest arrest rate per capita in the United States. So it clearly doesn't reduce arrest, because once you have a criminalized population, that population becomes more of a target. So just because you legalize sex work for some sex workers, there's going to be this black market if it's legalized instead of decriminalized, because there are going to be some people that either can't or won't operate within the legal structure that's been erected.
Like you're not allowed to sell cigarettes.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Like, so cigarettes are legal, but we, you know, have that guy who was killed by a police officer for selling Lucy's. So like,
poor Eric Garner.
That, right. Yeah, exactly. So like that, we don't want to create that, basically. But at the same time, when you're talking about appeasing fears of the general public, whether those fears are rational or not, talking about lowering STDs, preventing child slavery, or preventing, I just imagine if I was running for office right now, there'd be this video footage of me like giggling about Eric Garner's death and child slavery. And I'm just like, I'm just overwhelmed by the silliness of it. I'm not laughing at people's human suffering.
No, of course. No, but right. It's like preposterous.
It's preposterous, but it's like arrested
because they sold some tobacco.
Right. Well, illegal products.
They weren't licensed to sell or something. That's all ridiculous.
Of course. And like, you talk about like the black markets that are created because of these regulations. And I don't necessarily believe that no regulations is the answer to that. I understand why, as a country, as a community, and the tobacco industry has a vested interest in preventing the black market sale of illegal product. Like, I get that. And also,
or they do actually, because they would rather people sell them to children so that the children can get addicted faster without them being blamed.
It's, you know, like,
that's my conspiracy.
The higher you get, it's like the deeper it goes, you know?
Yeah. You just keep digging.
Bro. No, but here's what happened in Nevada, right? So you've got legal brothels. You've got a vested social and financial interest in targeting people who are operating outside of that legal structure. And sort of like in the food and bev industry, legal whores are kind of like waiters and also a little bit like comics, in that we're really all sort of lone wolves. Like, it's a real like transient workforce, which means that we can't really do the kinds of labor organizing that would make us go from a oppressive, draconian legal structure to a more tolerable, equitable, or fair legal system. We lack the social resources to do that because of the nature of the work and the way that it's structured. So, like, as a person, the personality cluster of whores is a little bit like the personality cluster of comics. Like, we just don't, we're not uber social. Like, there's definitely anytime that somebody tells me that they did any kind of sex work, there's this sisterhood thing that sort of kicks in. And like, whenever you're in a brothel, like there's definitely that, but it's not like, we're not like coal miners. You know what I mean? It's different in that way. And there's also
like, from my experience, that there's that understanding of like, if I see you in public when you're with somebody else, should I even say anything?
Exactly. Right. So we're all stigmatized women, and there's sort of like an oppressed class camaraderie that comes with that. But it's not the same kind of camaraderie that's going to easily lead to a successful like labor organizing movement. I think that fighting for destigmatization and fighting for decriminalization is going to get us more results than trying to form structured unions that might be able to advocate for our needs on a national level.
Wait, what do you mean? Can you repeat that again, that last thing?
I think that we're going to be better served as a community fighting to destigmatize and fighting to decriminalize than we are trying to create like a structured like labor union that is able to advocate for our needs on a local or a national level. Like, I don't think that we're going to have it. It's sort of like how the LGBT movement didn't try to create like unions, you know, like they're like destigmatize and advocate for their needs, but they're not like a legalized model of homosexuality would be, look, we know that there's like an increased risk of STDs, and we know that a lot of you guys are like mentally ill, so we're gonna need you to register with the local sheriff's office and only congregate here and like only do this, blah 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 blah. Like,
then you have to like obtain a license,
A license to do gay stuff or whatever. Like, if that had happened, I think that we would be, it'd be a step back instead of a neutral step.
I mean, that becomes like some Holocaust type shit.
Right. And because we keep playing whack-a-mole with horrors, like it just any kind of public registration or it just makes me nervous in my body, especially with Trump polling at 40%. I know a lot of people with like a background in labor organizing that think that they can apply the lessons of labor organizing to the sex industry. And I'm saying that, like, I don't think that labor organizing has worked for the service industry for the same reasons it's not going to work for the sex industry. You know, people don't really think of themselves as being career waiters. They sort of pop in and out. And the threshold of, like, filing a complaint or holding your restaurant accountable to even the few labor rights that we've managed to really fight for usually outweigh the cost of doing that. You know, when I walk into a restaurant, one of the tacit understandings is that restaurant is just as replaceable to me as I am to the restaurant. I think that like sex workers and brothel owners have a sort of similar tenuous relationship. So I think that that's one of the things that decriminalization could do is that for people that want to operate in brothels, it creates a competition among brothel owners to create the kind of work environment that people want to work in. Because if it's not the only brothel in town, then women can choose to work somewhere else. Whereas, and I think that's going to do more to
give,
increase
like, benefits to them,
yeah, benefits, the workers. Or just like not being a dick, you know, yeah. Like, so I think that that is going to have a better impact on sex worker rights than trying to create laws that are just as unenforceable as a lot of the laws that apply to restaurants here in New York that just go unenforced because no one cares.
So what resources are available now to sex workers? Are there any?
The internet.
The internet, but I'm saying, like, I know there's, like, sex workers' sure. rights groups. Like, what Absolutely. Are they doing?
So the sex worker outreach programs, projects that are all over the U.S., you know, Coyote is sort of one of, like, the first U.S. organizations. Pony, Prostitutes of New York was another one. You know, the sex worker rights, it's weird because it has a long history. I keep hearing, like, different origin stories. Like, the sex worker rights movement started in France in the 70s. It's like, no, it started in the U.S. in the 50s. No, it started in Asia in the 19-teens. It's like, no, we keep losing our origin stories because we keep whitewashing this history. So we don't have, like, a cogent narrative of what the sex worker rights movement is because we keep writing it out of our history books. So each generation has to, like, build the wheel again in terms of those resources. I am not an expert on sex worker activism, despite my tone. But I know the organization that I do the most work with that I love is the Sex Worker Project right here in New York that's associated with the Urban Justice Center. They provide legal counsel and services, free legal services, to sex workers, and they're staffed by predominantly former sex workers, which is fantastic. They also do, like, policy advocacy and have a real, like, harm reduction component and, like, philosophy that I appreciate because it's,
like, lawyers volunteer to work at that and things like that.
Yeah, and I think they have money that they pay lawyers on, like, they have lawyers on staff that really understand the issues, which is great. Yeah, the Sex Worker Outreach Project, SWANC. There are a lot of organizations that sort of just gather sex workers together, which is actually a huge achievement. Because in a criminalized state, it's very difficult to gather. And when you gather, you can share information. And that in and of itself is pretty incredible. So a lot of these organizations are really focused on just bringing sex workers together, which Twitter has done, the internet has done, the blogosphere has done, a lot of the same things that used to be done with zines. So it's great.
Yeah, that is great. Because I was thinking, if it was decriminalized, I don't know if this would be possible. Mm-hmm. I keep thinking that there could be, like, a special school that was, like, for sex workers, like, special sex education classes.
Well, it's weird because you've got pole dancing classes now, mostly for upper middle class bored housewives. divorced moms. Which is, you know, cool. You've got a lot of sex educators out there. Tantric sex seminars, you know, how to put a condom on with your mouth. You know, there's a woman out there that just goes around and does, like, Tupperware parties, but with dildos, where she, like, teaches women how to give, like, the best blowjob. Like, so a lot of that stuff is already legal. I think that taking a how to be a prostitute class is a little bit like taking a comedy class. Like,
probably,
it's really
yeah.
sort of more a thing that you learn in the field. And once you've been doing it for, like, a second, you meet somebody who helps you not die. Which
or is, you're just not stupid.
Right, yeah. But also, you know, if you're in bumfuck Idaho or something and you can take a comedy class online, it might help you more than, you know, trying to tell your dumb jokes into a microphone in a vacuum.
Yeah, so like the internet is a good, the internet makes it a lot easier. I hear what you're saying there.
Yeah, and I would say that, like, whatever your comfort level is, but try to avoid getting exploited. Like, try to avoid giving somebody thousands of dollars to teach you how to do a thing that you could learn. And also, we all learn differently. So I pay somebody to do my taxes because it's an unlearnable thing for me. So if there's some element of sex work that you're like, I can't do this, then you can definitely outsource that. And that's sort of what a lot of the pimping laws are, and what makes them super harmful is that some sex workers will hire, you know, answering services or security, bodyguard or a driver, or, like, you know, even a scheduler, like a personal assistant kind of thing, to help them with the business end of, like, screening clients and scheduling clients and, like, setting expectations and doing, like, the starting a small business part of sex work. And a lot of those people end up being prosecuted under the anti-pimping laws, even though when we think of a pimp, we think of a boss and not, like, a hired underling. So it gets weird.
That is weird.
Mm-hmm.
So something, this is a kind of a side thing. I keep thinking about how, you know, we have the police, and the police are not trained to really deal with anything relating to sex work, sexual assault, or mental health. Like, I'm wondering, what do you think of there being, like, an alternative team where there's, like, a team of people that exists just to, like, advocate for...
Like if the Special Victims Unit on Law & Order was, like, real?
Yeah, like, if they were, like, actually a team that knew what they were doing and they weren't the police. They were, like, a separate thing altogether.
Yeah, I think that, like, it's important. I don't know the answer to that, you know, because I think that, like, police are doing the job that we hire and train them to do, and the job that we hire and train them to do is to keep oppressed people oppressed. Like,
yeah, they're overseers. That's why they're right. Not the police at all. What I'm talking about would be, like, a totally different thing, which actually kind of sounds like
social service workers, or, like, I think that a lot of those kinds of things sort of exist. It's just a patchwork of, you know, this need exists, and so it gets filled by, you know, either a local sex worker advocacy organization that goes out there.
Yeah, like what you were talking about.
Right, or it gets filled by a social worker that is, like, willing to see past the bullshit and doesn't think of sex work as being the ultimate harm, but rather, like, you know, dead starving children being the ultimate harm, you know? Like, so I think that absolutely exists. I just don't think it's uniform.
Yeah, I hear that.
Yeah.
All right, so I'm going to stop this. So I know we talked a little bit about how animals engage in sort of a picture of sex work, like, mm-hmm. they exchange sex for goods and things that they want, but I have this, like, alternate world in my head that I don't know if it can actually exist, so feel free to comment on whether or not you think it can exist, but also just let yourself flow into the fantasy part of it if you want.
Sure.
So, like, in a matriarchal-based society, or whatever you want to call it, like, I believe that humans, like, people believe human nature is greed and selfishness, but I think some of that is influenced by the media, and I think some of that's influenced by religion, which in my opinion might exist to control large groups of people. And I think that, like, so that people can regulate and control resources for monetary gain, which I think leads people to believe that greed and selfishness are desirable.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if there was, like, a society, matriarchal or whatever you want to call it, where sharing and helping each other would be viewed as desirable.
Yeah, I think what's important to remember about society is that we get to just decide what matters, and mm-hmm. we get to create different metrics and different, like, ways of encouraging whatever we care the most about. So clearly right now what we care the most about is making money. But there are other ways to organize a society. And if you look at like the ways that other societies have been organized, valuing childcare, valuing you know, maternal health, valuing like these matriarchal values has definitely existed before and can exist again. So this is what I talk about, like sort of the 5,000-year thing, is that we recently, I don't know how recent it was, but if you read The Chalice and the Blade or like other you know, like weird radical feminist stuff, there's there's been some archaeological evidence to suggest that prior to 5,000 years ago, we had complex matriarchal societies that were structured really, really differently, that didn't have a lot of the same problems that we have now. They had other problems. You know, we don't, there's, utopias don't exist.
I know that.
But all of society was centered around a worship of the feminine. And you get these like cool sort of egalitarian, not everyone is equal, but the who is on top and who is on bottom is not gender or sexuality based.
It's leading more towards communal, whatever, whatever.
Right. I mean, it's not communal. You have like priestesses and you have poor people, but you also have like children who are being taken care of and like really like big investments in education and infrastructure and really cool stuff that happens. When you decide as a society that mothers matter more than soldiers.
I mean, I definitely agree with that. So I guess I was wondering, do you think that in these societies, like, would sex work naturally occur? Like, if there, if there was more of a focus on everybody getting their needs met, because that's what, in my imaginary world...
In your imagination, sex workers don't exist in this world because everyone's getting their needs met, so the need for sex workers is decreased? Is that the hypothesis?
No, I disagree. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, so, like, if sharing and helping each other be viewed as desirable and we're trying to get everybody's basic needs met, would, even if their money did not exist in this, would sex be something that people would do as favors for each other sometimes? Like, do you think that would just be something where people would just naturally fall into, like, a sexual priestess even?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, just, you've got sexual priestesses, which is something that, you know, it never made any sense to me that, like, sex, one of the most powerful human experiences that you can have, is so divorced from religious ritual. It feels like it would be something that you'd want to incorporate into religious ritual. If religious ritual is something you're into, I don't know. I lit a candle recently for my aunt, actually, because I wasn't raised Catholic, but I was baptized Catholic, because like both of my parents were raised Catholic, but then they gave up the religion before they met, so I wasn't really raised in it. But my aunt is dying from lung and brain cancer right now, and on the other side of the country, and I feel helpless and impotent, and she's in a lot of pain, and there's like nothing I can do. And so lighting a candle at St. Patrick's and taking a moment to like participate in that ritual that I know matters to her, and to have like just to carve out space to mindfully think about the pain and suffering of another, and to ask a higher power to reduce that pain and suffering, felt valuable in and of itself, even though I don't really buy into the like dogma of the Catholic Church, if that makes sense. So I would say, I mean, like, think about it. I know you've fucked people like because you felt like you owed them a favor, or because they were like going through something, or because you knew that sex was the best way to reach them, whether they were an acquaintance of yours or just like another, you know, traveler on the path. So I think that even outside of money, people have been having sex, especially women have been having sex with mixed motives forever. So I don't think that that goes away.
So we were talking recently and you said you don't identify as an activist anymore. I do. I want to hear about that. Because it sounds like you do, like, are vocal about sex worker rights. So what do you consider the difference between that, like, an advocate and an activist? Or, like, what are your thoughts?
An advocate and an activist speaks with an agenda. They've got a policy position or a fundraising goal or, you know, some objective-oriented way of thinking. And they're using different rhetorical tactics or different tactics to reach that goal. As an artist and as a comic, most of my communication is not goal-oriented in that way. My goals are things like laughs per minute or trying to get people to understand. It's not you know, I'm not really advocating for a specific policy position. I mean, you asked my opinion about decriminalization versus legalization. I'm happy to tell you that that's my opinion. I don't have a fundraising objective or a call to action or like a letter writing campaign that goes with that. I worked as an activist for a decade, for 10 years. And so I understand what that is and what it does to your brain. And I think that what happens when you are an advocate and you become an activist, you slip into team psychology and black and white thinking, and that can cloud your ability to connect to other people.
I was just like laughing at like, right. I was like, I got really stoned and like just sat here and just talked into the mic about like the show because that's what I do. You know, sometimes the show is just free associating. And I was just like,
can we smoke pot down here? Is that a thing?
No, we cannot.
Oh, okay, cool.
I smoke weed far away.
Far away. Far away. Far away.
But I just got really high and like came in here and I just started talking about how activists, I'm like, we're all just fighting all the time.
Right. And so
activists fighting other activists.
Like self-righteousness and, you know, thinking that you're right about an issue is fantastic if you're trying to get a piece of public policy passed or you're trying to reach a goal. Like, you don't, you know, I think it was Gerald Ford who was like, obstacles are those terrible things that you see when you take your eye off the goal. Like that kind of, you can make magic happen as an activist and as an advocate. And that is fantastic, and we need those people. I can't make my art and also be that person. I can't be the kind of comic I want to be. I can't be the kind of writer I want to be. I can't be the kind of friend and person I want to be in an activist mentality.
I just can't. Interesting, because I don't know if I actually like necessarily think that that's what I feel like I am as an activist. Mm-hmm. Like when I say, I don't know if I'm necessarily like working towards any policy change.
Right.
I feel like sometimes it's just trying to get people to think in like a little bit of a different mindset, which maybe might be part of that black and white thinking thing, but it's just more like, don't be like so discriminatory, like trying to get people to get out of the patriarchal mindset. So I guess that's like what I just try to talk, not, I don't know what I'm saying. I try to just not, I don't really want anything to reflect those patriarchal values, the anything that I make.
Right, and I would argue that if I were to let a huge chunk of my brain space get eaten up with that, I don't know that I'd be able to make a lot of the jokes that I make, for better or worse.
Oh, that's why I do less comedy, isn't it?
Yeah, so I feel like that like impulse to self-censor or, you know, the trying to fit in like among other activists and to like rally other activists and to play the sort of like politicized game of keeping other activists on your side, even though they might have like other interests. Like if you're a sex worker rights activist and they're a Black Lives Matter activist or like a labor rights activist and you're like, we're all on the same team for this goal and you got to make sure that you're like tiptoeing the right language. And it becomes, like a game of like jargon. Right, where like jargon is being used not necessarily to help people communicate, but rather to like signal in-group status versus out-group status.
Yeah, definitely.
And if you don't have the right fucking words, then you're like not a part of the group, so they won't like help you with your dumb goals. It's like that kind of shit.
That stuff's actually a little, I sometimes view that as a little bit classist, because I think a lot of that comes
It's a replacement of class. So like it's like rather than money, it's like access to this language.
Yeah, access to this language, I feel like sometimes is learned in liberal arts college, which are often attended by middle-class white people.
Sure. And then gets, you know, trickled down or trickle out or trickle sideways.
Tumblered or something.
Yeah. And, you know, people, it definitely becomes the, like, the nasty side of jargon. The in-group, out-group status of jargon. Usefulness of, yeah.
And I just wonder if that sort of behavior is influenced by how much businessy, like, argumentative stuff is in our society, if that's, like, inherent.
No, I think it's people. I think that even if you go back 10,000 years to these fantastic, you know, matriarchal societies, you still have
cliques.
You still have cliques that form in-group, out-group status, because otherwise you can't have a society that functions. I really do believe that. I think that, like, hierarchies and like social structure is necessary if you're going to have a sufficiently complex civilization, and sufficiently complex civilizations lead to really cool things like water treatment and technology.
Well, I believe,
and shared knowledge.
Well, I mean, that's what Marx believed. He believed that capitalism would like create the abundance of resources, mm-hmm. and then the people would take it back, and that's when we would have functioning communism.
Sure.
That's what he believed. I mean, I don't. Yeah, that's just theory.
Who knows?
That's just theory.
Yeah, or Trump could win, and we can go the other way. We'll be having a feudal society again. He'll build the next Versailles. We're gonna build the castle. Fuck the White House.
Oh my God.
We're gonna have Trump Tower.
No, we're gonna have Apprentice White House edition. The minute he gets in office, he's gonna fire Pence, and then
White
he has
House,
to, like,
the reality show.
You know, we're saying it as a joke, but
nothing is off the table. Oh my God, it's all fantastic.
Wait, when is Election Day?
November 8th.
November 8th. Oh, this is probably going to air afterwards. So this is going to be really funny for people to listen to this. That's, oh my God, I hope that we're talking to this. Everybody's like, thank God Hillary won.
Yes.
But I think that, so you ever heard of Punks for Trump? Punks for Trump?
It makes sense to me.
These are punks that believe that if Trump wins, he will do so badly that it will destroy the system and that they can come.
This fucking, like, liberal arts, you read a pamphlet on Marx, dumb cunt attitude of like, you know what, we definitely need a revolution because, like, you know, revolutions always end awesome for a fucking, here's the thing about revolution, here's the thing about fucking the structure of society right now, okay? I don't think that people get how fucking rare this is, okay? But the water works. We have functioning systems that are all deeply flawed and full of injustices, but, like, they fucking work. I get to stand on stage and say the word cunt over and over again and not get burned at the stake. And it took us thousands of years to get here. And if you have a violent revolution where you're tearing down a lot of these structures, I need you to understand the power vacuum that frequently, historically, over and over and over again happens after that is the further marginalization of already marginalized groups.
I agree with
period.
Yeah. I mean, we need to, I think it's, we need progress. We don't need to just, like, knock shit down. I agree with that.
Right.
I think we need to work towards ending racism and classism and sexism.
And I think that, like, technology has enabled us to build parallel structures that are fantastic. The share economy stuff is really fucking neat. The ability, like, Airbnb and Uber and Lyft and, like, and yes, there are absolutely problems. Specifically, you know, you compare taxi cab drivers to Uber and the protections and labor rights and blah, 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 blah. But we are building parallel structures that kind of sidestep a lot of this other stuff. But before you go throwing wrenches in machines, understand what the machine does and how it probably makes your life better, probably, in the question of this deeply flawed machine or no machine.
Yeah, I mean, I think I think it goes deeper than that. I think that there are some machines here that are good for us, but not good for people who live in this country. And then that's important to be aware of too.
Yeah, it's absolutely.
Just like we live in a pretty great country for white people.
Yes.
For white people, that's the important thing.
Yeah.
And then we live in a country that does a lot of things here that make it really shitty to live in other countries.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I mean, that's what I'm pretty concerned about that.
I'm not so concerned I don't have an iPhone, but I agree. Yes, there are systems and powers and institutions in place that make life shittier for other people in direct response to making it awesome to be a citizen of Rome.
Citizen of Rome.
Mm-hmm.
All right, do you have anything you want to close with? Because I think I'm going to tie this up.
Yeah, you definitely know a sex worker and think she's pretty cool.
Cool.
Definitely.
Yeah, definitely.
100%.
We definitely know. Oh, I mean, I'm a sex worker. Hello. I mean,
yeah.
I'm a stripper. I don't know if that really counts. I mean, it counts. I've done, like, weird foot fetish stuff. I deal with.
We're counting you. You're part of the red umbrella, bitch.
Yeah. Okay, great. That sounds...
Get under this red umbrella.
That sounds really good. all right. So this has been What Would Save the World. You can email me at 2, like the symbol 2, KEDALOW. Again, 2KEDALOW @gmail.com. Please email me all of your opinions. I want to read them on the air.
Forward them to me.
Oh, for sure. I mean, yeah, for sure. And I want you to come on this show and talk about anything you want.